Last time we were talking about the cordon classification system, which is a biological classification system developed by Fish and Wildlife Service and other biologists, but published through Fish and Wildlife Service in order to primarily establish some type of jargon for biological classification. And it has no regulatory capacity. Okay, so we talked about before, it's hierarchical. There are five different systems: marine, estuarine, riverine, lacustrine, and palustrine. And then the first four that I just listed also have a subsystem. Palustrine does not. And then there are classes, and underneath those there are subclasses, which describe more finer biological characteristics of either the substrate or the vegetation that's present. Okay, so we talked about the marine system, open ocean areas over 30 parts per thousand, except at the mouths of estuaries, and there are several other criteria here. And just keep flipping through these slides who are listening at home. So we have the marine subsystems, subtidal and intertidal, and then we have estuarine, et cetera, and blah, 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 and riverine, okay, et cetera, okay, lacustrine, and then finally palustrine. Okay, so what we ended on last time was talking about classes and the differences in, well, what a class is. And classes describe the basic appearance of either the substrate or the vegetation. And the cutoff point for the cordon classification system is 30% horizontal vegetative cover. If there's greater than 30% horizontal vegetative cover, then the class is distinguished based on the uppermost layer of vegetation. That's the tallest layer. And that means going from thinking of tallest being submergent plants to non-persistent emergent to emergent plants to shrubs and trees. Okay? And we'll get into those different classes here in just a moment. Okay. And then if there's less than 30% horizontal vegetative cover, then it's the classification or the type of class is based on or distinguished on given the texture and the composition of the substrate. All right? So that's where we ended. So y'all didn't miss much. Okay, so let's just take a look at this slide. Now, this next slide shows, there we go, let's turn off all the lights. It's just an image, okay, of a kind of mud flat type area. And without even knowing what the different types of classes that exist are, you can kind of take a look at that slide and sort of determine how many classes exist just by using the 30% horizontal vegetative cover, and also recognizing that there are different types of vegetation that are there. So, in taking a look at this slide, let's kind of think about how many classes may be present. Right, so go ahead and do that and think about that and count them up in your head. I'm doing the same. Let's see here. All right, so how many do you guys think there are?
Four.
Depends on where the edge of this mud flat is and how thick the shrubs are back there.
Okay.
The black mass.
Yeah, so that kind of depends on how thick those shrubs are back there. Let's actually assume that those are, we're standing a good distance from them, and those are trees, and that actually as you get closer to us over here in the forefront of the slide, that these shrubs actually, these are shrubs, and those become greater than 35% horizontal cover. OK? Okay, in that case, what do we have?
Five.
What would those be?
Trees, shrubs, the mud flat, the still standing water, and then the green vegetation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so the standing water that's over here is actually considered a different class than the exposed mud flat. And those classes are shrub, scrub, forested wetland, some type of emergent wetland plant here, and then unconsolidated shore and unconsolidated bottom. Okay, so let's go through those. All right, below, well, before we hit the different classes, below each of the sub, or each of the classes, you can then more finely describe the type of vegetation or substrate. Those are subclasses, okay? So they describe finer differences in vegetation life form or substrate characteristics, where the substrate is primarily broken apart based on the size, like for example, gravel versus sand, or the composition, sand versus organic, all right? And then dominance type is the taxonomic category of the most dominant taxa, okay? So if you have a class that's based on vegetation, where you have greater than 30% horizontal cover, then the dominance type is gonna be the most dominant plant species that are present based on the 50-20 rule. If it's substrate, then it's the most dominant animal class. And that usually means different types of invertebrate taxa, okay? That are just, that have colonized or exist or live within the soil. So use the 50-20 rule that we talked about before in order to determine dominance of those plants. Questions? Let me turn these lights back on so it's too dark in here. Okay. Oops.
Can I go back to the previous slide?
Sure.
What were the five again? Five classes?
The five? Oh, okay. Yeah, I did go through those fast, didn't I?
No, I wasn't writing down fast.
Okay, yeah. Well, we're going to go through each of these. So the question was, what are the classes that we talked about? We have shrub scrub, which is the shrubs. Okay, you have forested wetland, which is the tall trees. Then you have an emergent wetland, which is the green vegetation that you see here. Unless that's some type of submergent plant that just kind of got exposed, but let's just say it's an emergent plant. It probably is a non-persistent emergent plant, okay? And then you have unconsolidated shore, which is mud flats, and then you have unconsolidated bottom, which is basically mud flats that are covered with water, okay? And we're gonna go through each of those right now. Talk about the differences in those.
Was unconsolidated bottom? The wet area there?
Yeah, the unconsolidated bottom. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so how do you determine subclasses and dominance types? Well, you do that through some type of sampling methodology. And I will talk about different ways that you can go out and sample for your wetland mapping assignment. And of course, we used to teach in our department, FWF 410, used to teach folks that, but it's not offered anymore. So anyways, we will talk about different techniques that you can use. And I may get to that actually starting on and give you some ideas of how you might map your wetlands, because you'll need to determine, obviously, dominance types and whether or not there's greater than
3%, for example, horizontal cover.
All right. Okay, so now we're going to go through the different classes. Up at the top it says types of palustrin classes, subclasses, and dominance types. Actually, the classes that I'm going to go through and the subclasses do exist outside of the palustrin system. So just make that note that many of these classes do. And again, the that handout that I gave you last time that basically shows the breakdown of the systems, the subsystems, the classes, and the subclasses really kind of show you how these all fit together. Now there are three classes that I am not going to cover, and they're written up on the board: reef, stream bed, and rocky shore. And I want you to read about those within the assigned reading, and just learn about those independently. But all the other ones I'm going to cover. All right? Hey, Dan. No handouts today, just from last time. Yeah. Okay, so we're getting into talking about the different classes, Dan. And last time you might remember we talked about the differences that we're going to look at is whether or not there's greater than 30% horizontal vegetative cover.
Okay.
And if there is, we're going to do it based on vegetation. Otherwise, if there's less than that, it's going to be based on substrate. Right. And there are three classes that I'm not going to cover. Those are on the board, and just go ahead and read up on those in the one of the assigned readings, well, the classification system. Just look those up. Okay, so the very first one is rock bottom. And rock bottom, which is basically the same as rocky shore, except as you might intuitively think, the rock bottom is going to actually be covered with water, whereas the shore is the shore and it's exposed. So it's in areas where you have greater than, you have less than 30% horizontal vegetative cover, okay, so there's very little vegetation or none, and you have over 75% horizontal cover of boulders, stones, boulders, or bedrock. So these are usually high energy wetlands with well aerated water, or they are deep water habitats. Okay? So this is very common in, for example, the riverine system. Alright. The subclasses, and this is kind of how the order will go through the remaining slides. We'll start with the classes, and underneath the subclasses that are associated with that particular class we'll talk about. The first is bedrock, and that would be a case where over 75% of the horizontal cover was just bedrock substrate. Okay. The second is rubble, and for rubble that's less than 75% bedrock, but over 75% bedrock boulders and stones. We're dealing with, again, large pieces of substrate. The dominance types that you normally have here are, again, if it's not vegetation, then it's going to be some type of animal species. And for the most part, you're dealing with different types of macro invertebrates being the dominance types. And all the particular types of genera of aquatic macroinvertebrates that you would have present depend on how fast that water is flowing. Okay. So this is a typical type of scenario that you would have here for rock bottom on the next slide.
where it's usually associated with the riverine system. And as far as rubble is characterized as stones that are greater than 25 centimeters diameter. So I probably will not, like for example, during the test, I might give you different types of characteristics, but in as much as if I say rubble, that the substrate is composed of rubble, that gives away the subclass, I'll probably give the diameter size of the substrate. And then it'll be important for you to know that what the cutoff points are, put it into the appropriate subclass for a particular class. Okay. And this is, well, it's not common in the clustering system because you have usually fast moving water. And most commonly, that's associated with flowing water, usually within a channel, usually within the riverine system. Or as maybe as you get closer towards the coast, within the estuarine system. Okay. And it's certainly possible that it could be associated with a clustering system on basically flooded areas that are not on the shore, that are not, that are for the most part permanently flooded, but are composed of large rocks. Okay? Pretty simple. Any questions? All right. The second is unconsolidated bottom. And again, we have less than 30% horizontal vegetative cover. But the substrate is mostly composed of soil particles that are smaller than stones. And again, we're usually talking about low energy wetlands, or again, this could be lacustrine system as well. But they are usually flowing water is not part of the system. Okay. The first two subclasses are cobble gravel and sand. Cobble gravel, they have 50% cobble gravel, and same with sand. They have 50% horizontal cover of sand. Next two subclasses are mud and organic. Mud is greater than 50% horizontal cover of silt and clay, and organic is greater than 50% dead or live organic matter. And again, the dominance type depends on, are usually aquatic invertebrates. And the types of aquatic invertebrates that are present really depends on how stagnant that system is. And even the oxygen levels within that system. Okay, so unconsolidated bottom, again, are permanently flooded areas, just like the rock bottom, permanently flooded areas, but they have small substrate. Okay? Now, what is the difference between the sizes of these different substrates? I think y'all had last time this handout here that talks about the different sizes of substrate classes. Okay? And let's see, I think I have that. Yeah, I do. I've got it on this next slide for unconsolidated bottom. Where cobble and gravel are between 2 millimeters and 25 centimeters. Okay? And sand is between 0.05 and 2 millimeters. Everything less than that would be silt or clay, which would fall into the mud class. Organic would just be completely organic, well, organic soil. It's not talked about before when we talked about the different soil types. So primarily composed of that organic or fiber.
If you have a living layer, that's not necessarily organic soil, but it's the majority of what it's covered. Would you consider that organic or piece of that more like a
So
if it hadn't evolved to that organic composition within the soil.
Right. So the question is what composition does the, if you have an organic layer, does that constitute organic soil? And no, it doesn't. It needs to be incorporated in the soil. So just litter fall for 1 year doesn't, that hasn't become part of the substrate, doesn't constitute that organic composition. So you would need to take a core of the soil. All right. So again, very little or no vegetation. This is flooded soil, or again, you have a detrital. Soil that's mostly organic composition. Yeah. All right. As far as the palustrin system, which is, as far as palustrin and lacustrin, we're often in these systems here, the mud system, or even sand to some degree with lacustrin. But for the most part, unconsolidated bottom, the mud subclass is one of the most common. Okay, so here's an example of a picture of some images of the caudal subclass and the sand subclass. Again, these are usually, you're dealing with systems that have higher velocity water. So you're often, again, for example, within the riverine system or within the lacustrine system, on the edge of a lake, etc. Well, not on the edge of that lake, it would have to be permanently flooded. For the mud subclass, again, we're talking about permanently flooded areas. Like that there, you can see the center, unconsolidated bottom. Now this, the exposed mud flat is something that's different. That's unconsolidated shore with a mud subclass in this field. Okay? So you can, we haven't talked about unconsolidated shore, but we will in a second. That's the B class, the associated mud flats. If the substrate is primarily organic, then the subclass would be organic. Which again, that can be in stagnant systems or even systems with large flow. Okay. Any questions? All right. The third is aquatic bed, and for aquatic bed, we're dealing with submergent plants or floating plants. So, greater than 30% horizontal vegetative cover of plants that grow on or below the surface of the water, and less than 30%. Horizontal vegetative cover of any plants that are taller than that. Okay, so submergent and floating plants. And again, these are usually low energy wetlands that are permanently flooded. Okay, so there's four subclasses. You have algal, which would be systems that are completely dominated by algae. aquatic moss, rooted vascular, and floating vascular. Where rooted and floating vascular are the most common. Okay. And again, dominance types just depends on the type of plant species that are the most common. All right, so here's some images here. Again, rooted and floating vascular are the most common. And so again, the algal class is your subclass is, for example, the algal blooms. And aquatic moss, most common aquatic moss is the common water moss. And usually you find that subclass more often in stream systems and in riverine systems. All right. Rooted vascular are your pond weeds, like parrot feather or Fulton of Eden. Rooted vascular also includes your water lilies, because they are rooted. Bond. Floating is strictly floating, like duckweed or water hyacinth. So they have no root connection. Right. That's an important thing to remember, because when most folks see water lilies, they immediately think floating basket, but it's not. It's rooted basket. Number four is unconsolidated shore, so you're dealing with shorelines that again have less than 3% horizontal vegetative cover and less than 75% horizontal cover of stones, boulders, and bedrock. So you're dealing again with shores that have small, just like you did with unconsolidated bottom, have small substrate. So shorelines lacking hydrophytes. And again, these are the same, these subclasses are the same as they were for unconsolidated bottom. Okay. There is one additional one, but let me just make note that, again, as I pointed out in that other photo, if you see an exposed mud flat, it's unconsolidated shore, mud subclass. Okay, so that is a mud flat. Unconsolidated shore mud subclass. And there is one additional subclass with unconsolidated shore, and that is vegetative. And however, for this particular subclass, it is restricted to strictly non-hydrophytes. Okay, so plant species that are classified back minus or drier. And if these are areas that would become exposed, usually later in the growing season, you may have some type of species, like for example, cocklebur is a back minus species. It becomes established, and if it was flooded again, that plant would die. Okay, so these are mudflats that have become dominated by non-hydrophytic vegetation. So it's the only one here where you're talking about, again, unconsolidated shore, unconsolidated bottom. It's the only one that has actually vegetation, but the species that colonize it are not hydrophytes. Okay? So, yeah, back minus or below. And again, if it's substrates such as again like sand and mud, usually you're dealing with the dominance types are different types of inverts, If it's vegetated, then it's some type of back minus pioneering species such as cottonwood. It's a very common one because it has really good dispersal capabilities and can colonize areas pretty quick and has a relatively fast growth rate and reproductive cycle. So here's unconsolidated shore, lacustrine system here. This would be the sand subclass for lacustrine system. And again, the other ones I already mentioned, which again are all the same except for vegetated, they're the same as unconsolidated bottom. All right. The most common one, again, for the clustering system, and I kind of keep mentioning the clustering system because that is probably the most common, well, it is the most common wetland type that we have within the United States. But probably the most common that you would come across the clustering system is the mud subclass, and that would be, again, exposed mud plants. All right, so again, that was the sand subclass that we were just looking at. Here's an example of cowhorn gravel, unconsolidated shoreline, associated with the lacustrine system. Unconsolidated shore and mud flats here could be, again, a clustering or a lacustrine system. And examples of organic would be exposed detritus or moisture beds within the estuarine system, as long as it's not forming a reef. If you're forming a reef, when you read about the reef class that is present in the estuarine and can be present in the estuarine and the marine systems, if it forms a reef, then that it goes under that class. It doesn't go under this class. But if it's just for example, within the estuarine system, where it's not forming a reef, then it's the organic subclass. All right, vegetative, as I mentioned, is back minus or drier, back view and upwind as well. And one of the most common is aquifer. So, even if I don't give you a particular plant species, if I just give you the classification, you should be aware of that it's back minus and back to your left. All right, question? Okay, moss lichen wetlands, greater than 30% horizontal cover of mosses, lichens, less than 30% horizontal cover of other taller lands. Okay, these are wetlands of northern latitude. And again, it's just broken down into two subclasses of the mosses and lichens. reindeer moss is, Clavina is one of the most common lichens that you find as a dominant type. For mosses, sphagnum moss, peat moss is very common. Okay. And there's some images of moss. Moss lichen wetland, moss subclass, bogs, again, of northern latitude, very common. Reindeer moss, again, Ladina, it is common in one of the more common lichen species. Okay, now, on to the next one, emergent wetland. Emergent wetlands are wetlands with greater than 30% horizontal vegetative cover of erect rooted hydrophytes, excluding mosses and lichens, and less than 30% horizontal cover of invasive pollen. Okay, so there are two different subclasses. One is, so we've already talked about these, some already, one is persistent emergent. Persistent subclass of greater than 50% horizontal cover of plants that remain standing at least until the beginning of the next growing season. And that differs from non-persistent, which topple at the end of the growing season. And remember, depending on the size of the wetland and whether or not it is dominated by persistent or non-persistent emergent vegetation will separate it from being in a clustering class, clustering system, or lacustrine system. And so, do you remember what that cutoff is? For lacustrine, what is criteria? Okay, so if it's greater than 8 hectares, what is it then? Greater than 8 hectares. Does that separate it into a clustering on that? It does it? And what's the difference? If it's greater than 8 hectares, and what else? It's large, it's greater than 8 hectares, and the vegetation is not persistent emergent vegetation. If it is persistent emergent vegetation, then it is going to be the clustering system. Okay? Or if it's trees, which is shrub, and forest and whatnot. Okay? Good? All right, so dominance types, for example, cattail, bulrush, those are common persistent emergent plants. They'll topple until the final growing season. Various types of annual grasses, such as pinacloa, wild rice, panic grasses, sedges, most of the sedges that do top up. Yeah.
If it's greater than 8 hectares and it has greater than 30% non-persistent vegetation, it will not be interesting.
So if it has greater than 30% horizontal cover, non-persistent vegetation, and it's greater than 8 hectares. It is if there's one other criteria. Well, if it has wetland characteristics, it'll probably be in a topographic depression, but there's still another characteristic that's necessary. What else is that, y'all? Waveform chart. Well, that made it with us.
I think it was messy.
Well, that's right. It doesn't need that. It would, as long as
the salinity is fresh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you have fresh water. Otherwise, it pushes you into the estuarine system. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you're right. Any other questions?
Always another.
If it was fresh water, then that would push you into the estuarine system. It's possibly coming to the end of all those characteristics. So what we're talking about here are emergent wetlands. Emergent wetlands are things that are like moist, what I call moist soil wetlands, cattail marshes, playa lakes, rainwater basins. We'll talk a lot about emergent wetlands later on when we talk about management of wetlands for different types of species, shorebirds, waterfowl, amphibians. So here's some images here of persistent and non-persistent subclasses. Again, cattails, bulrush, asperges, where again, that stalk is remaining standing until the next growing season, then it falls over. Okay? And if you have non-persistent vegetation and you flood that area, it'll topple over. A lot of times you don't notice that it's toppled over at the end of the growing season, but if you put water on it, by the beginning of the next growing season, it'll look like an open lake. You kind of make that connection in your head, is that if it's non-persistent vegetation, okay, and it's large, right, then it's going to be a look like a lake. It'll be in the lacustrine system. Shrub wetland is a wetland that's dominated by shrubs, where for the according classification system, that's all woody vegetation shorter than 6 meters in height. Okay? Shorter than 6 meters in height. And you have less than 30% horizontal vegetative cover of trees, which are considered greater than 6 meters in height. So shrubs do not need to be some type of shrub species, like, for example, buttonbush. They could just be small trees. Right? So these areas are low-energy woodland wetlands. These are the subclasses. Broadleaf deciduous, broadleaf evergreen, needleleaf deciduous, and needleleaf evergreen. And probably the most common within the southeast are broadleaf deciduous and needleleaf deciduous. And there is one more, dead. And these subclasses are going to be the same for shrub and also for forest. All right, so you need to know a little bit about whether or not a tree species is deciduous or not. But that shouldn't be too difficult for y'all at this point in your career. All right, so what are we talking about? Dominance types, again, are different types of vegetation, different vegetative species. So broadleaf deciduous, example, broadleaf deciduous. You know, like tupelo. What about broadleaf evergreen? Mangroves. And needleleaf deciduous? All the cypress. Yeah. Amaranth. And then needleleaf evergreen.
really evergreen, you know, like spruces, up in more northern climates.
Probably within there. Could that be in bed? I was thinking in the Everglades, you know, aren't there areas in the Everglades that have pine trees that they can see the wetlands?
Well, usually, that's a good idea.
No, we don't have any pine here, but
right,
we can able to survive, but I think that may be.
Well.
And that may be too general, if you did something that maybe they could find but never could.
Yeah, I mean, most species that are in the genus Pinus, I mean, are upland plants, yeah.
Unless they've just been loving the plants.
Right, but they're probably not going to survive. Yeah, I can't think of.
Species called pine,
okay. Pine pine?
Yeah. There's a little where it wet and it dries up problem.
Do you know what genus it's in?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, well, that'd be good. Yeah, I don't know.
The pine rub seed, you know, the other draw is kind of the wall or up in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
the dry area. So here's an image here of some willows, broadleaf deciduous. And we'll talk about the importance of having scrub wetlands when you're managing for waterfowl, because they're very important areas for waterfowl to get in and provide thermal cover and escape cover from avian predators, as well as secluded areas where they can get in and engage in courtship behavior, which is occurring during the winter and early spring. Okay. Yeah. So yeah. Testial. So what's that? Yeah, button bush, right? So button bush is a common broadleaf deciduous shrub. And then, for example, mangroves. Again, these could be, most mangroves grow beyond 6 meters in height until they get really towards the seaward end of the extent of their extent when it starts to produce. Yeah. All these evergreens are not mangroves. What's that?
Holly?
Yeah, I don't know if pictures there of tamarack, willow deciduous, and various types of spruces and firs and cedars. All right. The eighth one is a forested wetland, and again, over 30% horizontal vegetated cover of trees, and that's woody vegetation that's greater than 6 meters in height. And notes there, shrub wetlands can become forested wetlands just with time as they grow. All right, Yeah, we have the same classes here, broadleaf deciduous, broadleaf evergreen, needleleaf deciduous, needleleaf evergreen dead. And again, variety of dominance types, especially in the southeast, a lot of different bottomland oak species, which is cherry bark oak, willow oak, overcup oak. And all cypress, etc. So the hardwood bottomlands of the southeast are forested wetlands. Again, mostly broadleaf deciduous, except where they're dominated by bald cypress. Any idea what that species is there, that oak species on the right? Mm-hmm. Pretty close. There. Another oak? It isn't.
It isn't another oak.
That's a pretty good guess. No oaks have really big acorns. Actually, do you know what that one is? On the left? What's that? It is a cherry bark. Very good. Yeah. That pagoda-shaped bottom leaf is pretty diagnostic. Purpose for those building. All right. Big ol' acorn. Burrow? Yeah, it looks like a burrow. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But it isn't. It isn't. Yeah. That's a good guess. That's an overcup oak. Yeah. And we'll talk about having bottoms that are dominated by overcup oak, which is a very water-tolerant oak species. It's actually the most water-tolerant oak that we have in the southeast. And these acorns are huge, which and they have that very thick and large cap. And anyways, that is probably just okay for a deer, but if you are a duck and you're trying to eat a huge acorn that has a really thick cap and may be hard to digest, that isn't, you may not prefer that, as opposed to something smaller like a cherry bark oak acorn. All right, and then probably evergreen, again, mangroves. Three species of evergreens, of mangroves in the western hemisphere. White, red, and black. Okay. Oh, here's some, like cypress. Have cypress knees. Mangroves also have, those are called pneumatophores. Mangroves have pneumatophores as well. And again, that helps them transfer oxygen, get oxygen down to their roots. And so that their roots can stay alive and saturated in saturated soil conditions, flooded soil conditions. Needleleaf deciduous could be tamarind or cypress, and needleleaf evergreen, cedar swamps, spruce swamps, northern latitudes. All right, oh yeah, and then of course the dead subclass. Now these are areas where it's greater than 30% horizontal cover. Maybe that's been ponded by a beaver. So we're getting over here on the right side, we're getting to where it's getting pretty darn open, and it may not meet that 30% horizontal cover criteria. And in that case, then it would be classified based on the emergent vegetation of the sea, which is probably a non-persistent plant. to go ahead and take just a little break here. What time is it?
6:02. All right. Yeah, we'll take a little break and then we'll get going again. All right, back online. So the last part of the coordinate classification system, we've gone through, again, the systems, the classes, the subclasses. In addition, read up on the ones that are up on the board again. And for those who are at home, that's reef, stream bed, and rocky shore. Okay, understand what those characteristics characteristics are necessary for those three additional classes. After that, then, and determining dominance type, etc., then you can also classify the wetland regime criteria, which is different than the cores. Remember, the core has the six different hydrologic zones, which are classified, which are used to classify and delineate wetlands. These are different, and they're a little bit more descriptive than the core's hydrologic zones. Okay, permanently flooded. Now, and these are non-tidal. These are non-tidal. There are also tidal water regime modifiers, which I want you to read over independently. Okay, make sure you make a note on that. All right. So there are actually four different non-tidal water regime modifiers. Read over those, please. We'll go over the non-tidal ones here. Okay, the non-tidal are permanently flooded. That means that water covers the substrate in all years. Okay, it's permanently flooded, right? Intermittently exposed means that the water covers the substrate in all years except during a drought, like this year. Okay, so most of the time it is flooded. Semi-permanently flooded is water is covers the substrate throughout the growing season in most years. Okay? But then it may become dry during not during the growing season, outside the growing season. Seasonally flooded is water covers the substrate for extended periods of time, especially early in the growing season, but it is absent by the end of the growing season. So seasonally flooded, and this is a very common wetland regime, water regime for wetlands, where they're flooded for a good portion of the growing season, but as the summer goes on, high evapotranspiration rates, water evaporates, and they're dry by the end, and then they may fill back up with fall or winter rains. Or maybe stay dry all the way until spring rains or spring weather. Okay? So these, again, these are a little more descriptive, kind of a little more biologically, well, related to biological characteristics that could potentially influence plants where again, with none of the core, it is based on a certain percentage of the growing season. All right, saturated is that the substrate is saturated, but surface water is seldom present. Okay. So like in seed type areas. Temporarily flooded, surface water is present for brief periods. During the growing season, the water table is usually far below the surface for the remainder of the year. Many of the mineral soil type wetlands, hardwood bottomlands, riverine wetlands, fall into this category. Okay, where they're only flooded for a short period of time. Okay. Intermittently flooded is substrate is exposed. But the surface water can be present for variable durations, but without predictable seasonal periodicity. And then finally, artificially flooded is that basically it's the hydro period is being influenced by humans, right? Through pumps or dams or
or some other types of water control structures or devices. And those are the eight non-tidal water regime contractors. Okay? And so when you're classifying, mapping your wetlands, you will want to at least try to classify the water regime characteristics. That's your adult regime. With recognizing that it is during a drought year. So you look for, and we already talked about this before, how do you map these or how do you determine these? You can assume that when you are mapping this fall that you are during a drought year and you're during low water period. Okay, so it isn't going to get any lower than this probably in any other year. All right, so keep that in mind and think about these characteristics of what would happen probably in most other years. If it's permanently flooded now, it's permanently flooded. Okay? But there can be a zone around there that probably would normally be permanently flooded, and then that would be semi-permanently flooded, but it is an issue because it's a drought. So just kind of keep that in mind, and you map those zones, those different zones. Any questions? Usually your water regime will kind of show this here in a second, but when you're mapping, you map your system, your class, your subclass, and then you attach to it these modifiers. Okay? So, and it goes in that hierarchy. Instead of having just a map, it's just the water regime. It's usually the vegetation and the substrate, etc., are falling right in line with what you would classify the water regime as. And as that changes, you have different zones of vegetation. Okay, water, you can also classify water chemistry. And for all of our systems, you can see them fresh. All right, but there are four categories of salinity: hyperhaline, which is greater than 40 parts per thousand; euhaline, which is 30 to 40; mixohaline, 0.5 to 30; and then fresh, less than 0.5. And so we're dealing with freshwater systems here, unless you guys need to go map someplace on the coast, which I don't think too. If you look in the Cordon classification manual, I think they break these down even into finer categories. But this was the original classification system with just four categories. Now they may have six or seven. Yeah. But, okay. And pH is, acid is less than 0.5 pH. And there's circumneutral, which is 5.5 to 7.4, and then alkaline, which is greater than 7.4. And actually, I think I was looking at that manual, and they had it indicated as this. I think they had this as greater than for acid, greater than 5.5, and less than 7.4. Yeah, for alkaline. So just make a note of that if you're reading that thing. But you could have figured that out yourself. But they made a typo. Anyways, now what do I expect you to do? Well, you all know what the salinity is. Okay, you can do that. You can do the water regime modifiers. Okay, by looking and looking at different hydrologic indicators, drift lines, etc., with vegetation and with water, current water is. Do you have to do pH? No, you don't have to do pH. So that's one thing you don't need to map through your wetland mapping assignment. All right. What about soil? Yeah, I do want you to look at soil characteristics. Again, you're going to need to look at soil characteristics anyways to determine if there's hydric soil conditions. But in the process of looking at that, get a feel for whether it's mineral or organic. And again, I would eyeball it as far as whether or not it exceeds that greater than 20% organic carbon. So, which these are exactly the same criteria we went over already with respect to looking at hydric soils and the difference between mineral and organic. Because we know if it's organic, we know that it's definitely hydric, but there are many wetlands that have mineral soils. Okay? They're just water for less duration, so all the organic matter decomposes. And so they have, you just have to look for other types of characteristics which are representative of anaerobic conditions that develop when areas are flooded. Okay? And remember, this is the depth. Okay, remember that, make sure you remember that depth that you're going to take your soil for. It's at 16 inches. Okay. Any questions on that? Maybe next time down and bring us our soil for. The plan is next time is to start to talk about wetland mapping and kind of get you all thinking about how you go out and map your wetland. And I will just really kind of talk about, well, I'll talk about national wetland mapping efforts, and then I'll get more specific directly towards your assignment, start talking about that and how you would set up a design first of all, and the different plot sizes you might use, to what the differences in dominance types of vegetation, how you might sample the soil, etc. And then that'll lead into later on, well, a week from today, Dr. Roberts from TTU will be over here to talk about hydrogeomorphic classification of wetlands. So the wetland mapping discussions will break between this Thursday and the following Thursday, which we'll finish up and we'll be meeting over in the Kasner computer lab. And John will do some stuff about GIS to show you how to create maps and GIS.
Are you going to have these PowerPoints
I don't have them yet, but I will send him an email and see if I can get them for him. If not, then I'll see if I can get them printed off before class. Okay, so there also are some special modifiers, and these are basically just to provide some more information about your particular wetland, and they're usually related to different anthropogenic modifications, such as if it's an excavated basin or a channel, if it's impounded. Impounded means that the structure prevents the outflow of water, like a dam, okay, like farm ponds, for example, impounded. And dike means it prevents inflow of water, okay? And you let water through a dike system. And that's just the way that this classification separates the differences, whether or not you're holding water back or whether or not you're letting water in. And okay, partly drained is water level has been artificially lowered, the hydrophytes and hydrophytic soil are present, so kind of a ditched area. Farmed is if the soil is mechanically disturbed, but hydrophytes will reestablish a farm in seasons. If somebody's gone down in and farmed, disc up a wetland and then plant some soybeans or something. I do mud flats, right, John? I'm sure mud flats have crops on them this year. They never flooded. And finally, artificial is non-natural substrate. So, you know, if there's, you know, some type of, you know, some dumping that that exists, the car engine, whatever, you know, dredge spoil, whatever. Okay? You just map that specifically within the wetland and indicate that it's artificial. All right, so let's go through an example here and see how good you guys are at classifying. Now, last time I handed out, again, this alphanumeric code, and there are two different alphanumeric codes that I handed out. You know what, I don't have the other one. Yeah. Yeah, so it looks like there's this one here. There's wetlands of delineation, the coordinate all alphanumeric code. And it goes through and it says system, and there's, it gives the letters for the system. Subsystem, the number for subsystem you can get off of this other one. So there's two that talk about, that give you alphanumeric codes. It's up to you which one you want to do, because actually this is my code system that I've developed. But you can use this one, or you can use this one, which is actually officially for the classification, the one that they recommend you use. So it's, anyways, that's up to you, but make sure that when you hand in the wetland mapping assignment that you either, well, you should include one of these, okay, as an appendix or something, an indicator in the text that, you know, what your code refers to. Now, we'll talk about actually writing those codes here in just a second. All right. So what you're going to do, and the reason that those codes exist, is so that on a map you can very succinctly indicate the type of wetland that is delineated. Okay. And instead of writing out, you know, palustrine, forested wetland, shrub, you have a code there that it indicates that type of wetland. All right, so here's an example. We have a wetland here that indicates that it's during September, it's 1.5 meters deep, the salinity is less than 0.5 parts per thousand, pH is 6.0, organic carbon is 50%, let's see. Okay, 50% organic carbon in this flooded region that you can see here, and then back by the trees, it's 10% organic carbon. All right, so let's go through and see if we can think about what these different zones are. All right, how about, I can't remember how. Let's start with this vegetation here, which is standing up. It is cattail. And first of all, what system are we dealing with here? Yeah, we're dealing with the palustrine system. Okay. What would make it lacustrine? That's right. That's exactly right. It doesn't have persistent emergent vegetation, does it? Okay, so now, what about this zone here, okay? This is persistent emergent vegetation. What about out here? Can this still be, is this still palustrine? Could be. Or it is. It is, why? Because it's less than 2 meters deep. That's right. That's right. Okay. All right. So we said that this is palustrine, and then persistent emergent vegetation. see, what's the soil type?
As far as the modifiers?
Well, yeah, it's organic, yeah. It's organic. And the salinity? It's fresh. And the pH?
Circular neutral.
Okay, so let's see. So the way that you indicate the code here is we have palustrin. So you first of all put down the system, then you put down the class, emergent. O1 is persistent. Then you have either a forward slash or you have a dash that then separates your subclass, your system and class and subclass from your modifiers. So, let's see, in order here, forgot to do the water regime thing, didn't I? SP is semi-permanently flooded. O4 is fresh. And C is circum-neutral, and O is organic. Okay?
Do you want to go with yours, the test, since it's easier?
For the test, what I'll do is ask, yeah, for mapping, it's up to you. You can use either or. It doesn't matter to me. You will need to use, because I don't have the subsystems, I don't have the numbers here, you'll have to use their subsystem numbers. But everything else is there. So that's up to you. That's your prerogative. Yeah, I'm not going to make you remember all these codes for the test. Yeah, that's why you have these things to refer to, these sorts of legends. You'll have to remember what, when you have cattail, what it is. And I would need to give you some description of how permanent the water is. Okay. All right, how about that area right there? So top left of the image looks like it's some woody vegetation, maybe about 3 meters in height. I'm guessing that those are some willows back there. So, So what is that? PSS01 is what? Broadleaf deciduous for willow.
That's right.
Now, I'm not sure how else that. Was that seasonally flooded? Yeah. Everything else is the same. So this is just seasonally flooded back here. Alright. And then O4C, which is, fresh, circum-neutral, and organic. Alright. Now back there in the trees, what are we dealing with? Let's say those are primarily oaks. PFO1, so western forested wetland, broadleaf deciduous. And back there, the carbon content is 10%. Yeah, so that'd be mineral, right? And fresh, circum-neutral, and T is temporarily flooded. Again, I would need to, give you some description of what the hydrocarrier is like. All right. The other option, too, is that could be an upland area. And so when you're mapping, omega is the symbol for upland. So that is where your wetland will end, and you will have omega symbols around indicating the upland zone. Question that that's come up before when you're mapping is, well, how big does your wetland need to be? And I would say that needs to be, you know, an acre in size. You know, so it's decent. I'm not, you know, mapping a mud hole or something like that. Okay. But it also doesn't need to be, you know, hundreds of acres. If you have an area, go ahead and limit the area that you map. Maybe if it's like a riverine wetland or something, well, you could actually map all the way out to the Gulf if you wanted to, right? So go ahead and limit the area, you know, to a reasonable distance. I don't know if you're going to do that, just ask me, but I would probably say a couple hundred meters linear length along a creek. Okay, what about this area here? Okay, palustrine. Aquatic bed. Revascular, that's right. And then it will have the same, yeah, it's going to be permanently flooded. Permanently flooded area. I guess that would be the water regime. And, what do I have? Intermittently exposed. Yeah, maybe during a drought, maybe it would be dry this year. That is certainly possible. A lot of marshes and farm ponds are dried up this year. Okay, and then the same stuff, fresh, circle, neutral, organic. And just go in that order with respect to, you know, you have your water regime, you have your water, salinity. Well, you won't need to do pH. And soil type, for permanently flooded areas like that, you can probably assume that it's going to have a pretty high organic composition. If it's permanently flooded, the substrate's going to have a high organic composition. Well, constructed wetlands.
Yeah.
It would take a few years to get to try that.
I think it's 7 ounces.
Sure. Oh, yeah, right. Like 7 ounces, yeah. Yeah, you need a, you know, probably, well, a couple of years for it to be permanently flooded. Okay. That's pretty simple, huh? Good stuff. All right. More practice. All right. So the depth here is between 0.1 and 1.9 meters. The salinity is less than 0.5 parts per thousand. pH is 8.5. Let's see. Shortly after spring rains, so this is as wet as it's probably going to get here. Let's see. Soil size is 0.1 millimeter, and there's 30% organic carbon, and you have annual plants, perennial plants, and mangrove. Okay. All right. So that arrow, top left arrow, is pointing towards, I believe, those are mangrove bushes. So what would that be? Is it? Okay, it's the open water then. Is it? Okay, because I can't, you know, y'all may have a code there already. So what would that be if it's the open water? Is it sand? Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a clustered unconsolidated bottom, and what I say was sand. Is it? Oh yeah, it's 0.1 millimeter. Yeah, down here. Yeah, I gave you the soil size. Let's see. Cluster on consolidated bottom. Yeah, that's right. Sandy soil. Permanently flooded. And yeah, fresh, alpine, organic. There, that one's the top right is the point, I think, where the vegetation. So if that's mangrove. Probably about evergreen, blustering, shrub, probably evergreen, and it's probably going to be intermittently exposed. Let's see, yep, intermittently exposed. This is freshwater alpine organic. Okay. All right, that's cattail. Persistent emergent, right? And then, flustering. Water regime is, I guess, have a season of flooding. And maybe then a full floor KL. All right. Right here in the bottom left, the foreground is some sedges, which top up the end of the growing season. Yeah. So then in that case, it's blustering, non-persistent emergent. So BMO2, it's again, that area is temporarily flooded, and O4AL. I would have to give you more of a description of how long the water is there. Usually your low water period is during the fall, so if I indicate, I may just indicate this is at low water. And if you're looking at a permanently flooded zone, you should be able to, you know, indicate that it's permanently flooded. And then as you move closer and closer towards the upland, then you go from intermittently exposed to semi-permanently flooded to seasonally flooded to what's next? Intermittently flooded? Temporarily flooded. Yeah, temporarily flooded and intermittently flooded. And then saturated, usually that's, again, those are like lowland bog areas that are just always saturated, but there's, you know, where the groundwater is really close to the surface. Those are actually called discharge wetlands. All right. So there's a little bit of some practice with thinking about systems, etc., and different classes and subclasses. Again, I kind of recommend that you read through the classification system, get very familiar with it. I guess it's not too long if you have a test on it, and then you all will be very intimately exposed thereafter with mapping. And so by the time you finish that, you ought to be pretty good at mapping wetlands. Yeah.
The water regimes, it doesn't. I mean, not. I don't
know if you said,
but on here it's
got
the tail
for
the non-tidal water.
Oh, does it? Yeah. See, they added some. That handout that you have is updated. Let's see, it says there was.
It's a center added for mapping.
Yeah, so they have added some additional ones. In fact, they have a bunch of them, don't they?
Yeah, the twin title.
Yeah, twin title and so they have added some new ones. And so that was after National Wetlands Inventory Program, but you know, as long as you remember the ones that there are four original vital water regime modifiers. So I would go from what's in the manual itself. Yeah, instead of from this. You can certainly use this alphanumeric code to classify things. As far as remembering and learning, go ahead and go straight from the manual. All right. Let's see. That's it. So, any questions? Okay, so next time we'll get into kind of doing some wetland mapping stuff, and